In some eliminationist assaults, the perpetrators treat children utterly differently from their parents by choosing not to target them. This was true for communist regimes which, unlike the Nazis, did not target children. The Soviets, who, in consigning the vast majority of their victims to the Gulag, did not include their victims' children, though when they expelled entire minority groups or kulaks from their homes and regions, the children suffered and died along with their parents. The Soviets knew the children were themselves not a manifest threat and could always be reared in the ideological school that Soviet society was as good communists. In other eliminationist programs against heretics, the perpetrators have similarly often spared children, at least when targeting people for real or alleged political beliefs and actions. This appears to have happened frequently during the Indonesians' slaughter of communists. The perpetrators have not seen heretics' children as guilty. They are pre-political, and could therefore safely live with their surviving relatives. The Indonesian often also spared women, or be raised by others and imbued with the dominant group's worldview. Eliminationist perpetrators' second mode of treating children is to subject them to a less severe eliminationist fate than that of their parents. This occurs frequently when perpetrators employ various means, including but not only annihilation, or when the assault is selective, focusing on weakening the enemy with strategic killing. The number can still be enormous of part of a targeted people. The Serbs, in their eliminationist onslaughts both against the Bosniaks and the Kosovars, restricted their targeted killing mainly to men and teenage boys. They did not systematically target younger children for death, instead expelling them together with their families and communities' remnants. Perpetrators eliminating many peoples, even when targeting children, often are less consistent in killing them, because whatever they believe about the victim peoples, the children are, after all, just children, and manifestly not threatening. For them, perpetrators often choose lesser eliminationist means, such as expulsion. Finally, in the third modal treatments, perpetrators dispose of children as they do adults. When a political community conducts an all-out, unrestrained eliminationist assault on a minority, the perpetrators tend to victimize children as if they were mere smaller adults. Nottingham, the former British district officer in Kenya, explains how the British, who certainly recognized that Kikuyu children had committed no transgression, could nevertheless treat children cruelly and murderously. By the time that I'm talking of, the fact that a child was almost irrelevant. The point was, he was a Kikuyu. This has been true for perpetrators assaulting targets deemed subhumans, existential enemies, or heretics. The German annihilators of the Herero and Nama, the Japanese in Nanjing and elsewhere, the Germans' treatment of Poles, Russians, Sintis, Roma, and others, Britain's mass incarceration of Kikuyu, the Khmer Rouge's eliminationist slaughter or imprisonment of virtually all of Cambodian society, the Syrian slaughterers of Hama's people, Saddam's assault upon southern Iraq's Marsh people and northern Iraq's Kurds, the Sudanese killers in Darfur. In Guatemala, where the perpetrators' cruelty toward children was, in general, widespread and acute, they particularly targeted boys, like men, according to the perpetrators themselves, to prevent Mayan society's regeneration and future retribution against them. Well, they told my sister, since among the soldiers there was one who spoke our language, and he told my sister that they had to finish off all the men and all the male children in order to eliminate the guerrillas. And why, she asked, and why are you killing the children? Because those wretches are going to come someday and screw us over. That was their intention when they killed the little ones, too. Another Maya explains further. The army's plan was to get rid of the seeds. Even if it was a little 1 or 2 year old child, they are all bad seeds, so they say. This was the army's plan. This is what I have seen. The brutal real politic behind the perpetrator's treatment of existential enemies and the utilitarian calculus perpetrators use for handling subhumans, together with the general disinhibition of internal restraints both mindsets produce, lead perpetrators to dispose of their victims' children as they do their parents, often to ensure the seeds will never sprout, that their putative problems never regenerate. Neither social theory, real politic, or brutal utilitarianism gives the perpetrators any general reason to privilege children. The Guatemalan perpetrators generally did not, except for those they kidnapped and enslaved. Guatemala's foremost forensic expert, Pecorelli, explains the perpetrators' regular mode of killing children. Yeah, basically swung children into rocks, trees, anything big and stable that you can smash a kid up against. The little older kids, the little heavier, harder to handle, they would just shoot. And then the older ones, a combination of everything, a combination of gunshot wounds and to sharp force trauma. These three modal ways in which perpetrators treat targeted groups' children, exempting them, going easy on them with lesser eliminationist means, and treating them no differently from their parents, are instantly comprehensible, covering a normal range of options. There are two additional, less frequent perpetrator means of treating children. With the first, perpetrators hold children to be actually or potentially different and better than their parents' fate. In some instances, owing to the perpetrator's social theory, they treat children of groups targeted because of ethnicity or nationality radically differently from their parents. The Turks, conceiving of their existential enemies, the Armenians, not entirely coherently, an unstable agglomeration of a national, ethnic, religious-based hatred, nevertheless had a decidedly non-racist view of them. This permitted the Turks to think of young Armenian children as redeemable because they had not been, in a sense, Armenianized by being inculcated with an unalterable Armenian identity, cultural practices, or characteristics. In principle, the Turks could spare young Armenian children, allowing Turkish families to take them in, convert them to Islam, and raise them as Turks, which they did by the tens of thousands. The Turkish leadership enunciated this principle as policy when planning the exterminationist and eliminationist program. The fifth of their Ten Commandments for conducting the eliminationist assault: apply measures to exterminate all males under 50, priests and teachers, leave girls and children to be Islamized. Although the Turks killed most Armenian girls and children, often cruelly and gleefully, such as by swinging them and smashing their heads, and although kidnapping children is barbaric, the Turks' choice to spare such children's lives reveals their social theory's power to get them to substantially depart from their otherwise utter eliminationist brutality, and that the flow of fellow feeling and human pity was not indiscriminately dammed up in them. Allowing some Armenian children to live likely provided balm for some Turkish perpetrators' consciences. They could tell themselves they were exterminating only those leaving them no choice. But without the social theory guiding them, at odds with the social theories informing many other eliminationist assaults perpetrators, they would not have allowed the Armenian children to live, albeit as Turks. In this respect, and in forcing an enormous number of Armenian women to convert or to enter slavery, the Turks, exceptional among the perpetrators of our time's mass murders and eliminations, resembled pre-modern times eliminationist warriors who also incorporated the vanquished people's children and women into their communities. In other instances, usually of heretics, perpetrators do not target children, as the Soviets did not for most of their victims, and the perpetrators of some of Latin Americans' dirty wars against leftists did not. In these instances, the perpetrators could be seen as conceiving of the children as the Turks did of the Armenians. But instead, these are episodes of perpetrators being wrathful against particular adults because of their real or alleged individual beliefs or actions, and not because of ascriptive characteristics such as ethnicity or nationality, which means that the perpetrators harbored no direct eliminationist animus toward their target's relatives, including their children. The Germans, governed by their idiosyncratic racial biological view of humanity, also stole children from the vanquished, but not from all the groups they were slaughtering or eliminating. The Nazis' race theory held, bizarrely, that a person's individual physiognomy governed his racial destiny, meaning that a Nordic-looking child born to Slavic parents, be they Poles, Ukrainians, or others, was of sound, indeed exalted biology, and should, indeed must, be incorporated into the master race's community as one of its own. As Himmler confirmed in his 1943 speech to the SS leadership, "Whatever is available to us in good blood of our type, we will take for ourselves. That is, we will steal their children and bring them up with us, if necessary." The Germans created an extensive formal program to identify these individually, putatively, physiognomically privileged children, kidnap them, and deliver them to German families for adoption and putative master race acculturation. They conducted modern times' most extensive child kidnapping program to incorporate into the German racial body unknown thousands of such children. Jewish children's fate at the Germans' hands was the opposite, constituting the other principal exception to the three modal ways perpetrators treat children. The German perpetrators did not subject Jewish children merely to their parents' brutal and lethal fate, but often treated them worse. The added callousness, if not enjoyment, that perpetrators express just by subjecting children's helpless and extra vulnerable beings to the same privations as their parents was fully evident among the Germans. They inflicted enormous suffering on Jewish children by starving them, often to death. The Warsaw Ghetto Camp's official daily ration was 350 calories, forcing them into the ghetto's hellish living conditions. The Warsaw Ghetto's population density was, according to German statistics, initially 6 to 7 people per room. Deporting them, like their parents, packed like sardines in nearly airless, locked freight cars for days on end. They killed them mercilessly. But in several ways, the Germans' ferocity and cruelty toward children exceeded even their treatment of Jewish adults. The Germans often slaughtered Jewish children before their parents, leaving the adults alive for days, weeks, months, resulting in many Jews surviving the war without their children. In Auschwitz and other camps, they reflexively killed arriving Jewish children. When the Germans learned a Jewish woman was pregnant, they killed her immediately, often in a brutally cruel manner. This was officially conveyed in the infamous Jaeger Report, an itemized accounting of the Germans and their local helpers' slaughtering of 137,346 Jews in the comprehensive extermination program's first months in Lithuania, which starts off, "Today I can confirm that our objective, to solve the Jewish problem for Lithuania, has been achieved." They left alive only those Jews needed as temporary workers. Karl Jaeger, as if to allay possible concerns about the long-term consequences for the exterminationist project of temporarily enslaving these Jews, discusses in his report one of the Germans' complementary eliminationist means. "I am of the view that the sterilization program of the male worker Jews should be started immediately, so that reproduction is prevented. If, despite sterilization, a Jewess becomes pregnant, she will be liquidated." The German perpetrators reacted with fury upon encountering a pregnant Jewish woman, putatively harboring the biological seed of the Germans' undoing, their view of the gestating child. The sight of a pregnant Jew carrying a future life did not warm the Germans' hearts, but incited a heightened consciousness of danger threatening to multiply before their eyes. This also occurred when they came upon Jewish infants and young children during roundups and deportations. The Germans often killed them in the most gruesome manner, shooting them at point-blank range in their mother's arms, or, after snatching them, swinging them by their heels to smash their heads against a tree or a building wall. This was the purest rage, having no purposeful domination or demonstration purpose. It was their hatred's expression at coming across the symbol of their putative enemy's future and hope, a threat born of the Germans' hallucinatory sense of endangerment. An adult brutally killing another adult face-to-face involves an element of domination, establishing in the final second a clear, unalterable master and victim hierarchy that each recognizes before or even as the perpetrator strikes the final blow. But a young child, an infant, cannot comprehend this and therefore provide the psychic satisfaction perpetrators the world over take in looking into their victim's eyes, reflecting back the perpetrator's physical mastery and desired emotional and moral mastery. The Germans' unsurpassed drive to destroy Jewish children, they slated every Jewish child for death, their extra ferocity and brutality toward them, and their obvious special, cruel satisfaction in inflicting cruelty on them, set them apart yet again. No exterminationist program has come close to matching the Germans' systematic and obsessive killing of children, so much so that they devoted considerable resources to ferret out hidden Jewish children. This distinguishes the Germans even in the long history of annihilative and eliminationist assaults upon Jews, whose perpetrators' fury rarely targeted children or systematically hunted and slaughtered them. The Tutsis' brutality toward Hutu children in Burundi and then, on a still broader scale, the Hutus' brutality toward Tutsi children in Rwanda appear to have been kindred, exceeding even the baseline brutality and murderousness they showed adults. Similar to the Germans' conception of Jews, Hutu and Tutsi each saw the other group's children as the biological spawn of evil. The licentiousness and ritualized manner of each group's slaughtering the other's children bespoke an unusual viciousness exceeding even conventional eliminationist baselines used for adults. A Hutu survivor from Burundi recalls how girls, who would otherwise grow up to be fertile women, were, with unmistakable symbolism, killed, and by whom? The Tutsi girls in secondary school, they killed each other. The Tutsi girls were given bamboos. They were made to kill by pushing the bamboo from below, from the vagina, to the mouth. Another survivor recounts a second transparently symbolic manner of destruction. There was a manner of cutting the stomach of pregnant women. Everything that was found in the interior was lifted out without cutting the cord. The cadaver of the mama, the cadaver of the baby, of the future, they rotted on the road. Not even a burial. Formulated with tragic poetic insight, the cadaver of the future rotted on the road. A doctor who fled his hospital in Rwanda after Hutu slaughtered its 150 to 170 patients, including wounded children, explained why the Hutu killed a Tutsi nurse 7 months pregnant. Her crime, according to the murderers, was she was carrying a Tutsi baby. He did not need to add that for the Hutu, the not-yet-born baby was guilty of only one thing: being Tutsi. The Hutus' utter pitilessness and brutality toward Tutsi children did not mean they always treated the youngest with the excess cruelty they did adults. Precisely because babies have no understanding, these condign and vengeful torturers benefited little from torturing them as they did adults. Babies, according to the perpetrator Alphonse, were whacked against walls and trees, or they were cut right away. But they were killed more quickly because of their small size and because their suffering was of no use. They say that at the church in Nyamata, they burned children with gasoline. Maybe it's true, but that was just a few in the first day turmoil. Afterward, that did not last. In any case, I noticed nothing more. The babies could not understand the way of the suffering. It was not worth lingering over them. Setting out to annihilate or otherwise eliminate people considered to be demons can lead perpetrators to intensely focus their wrath on the children, representing the future race of demons, an unending threat. Mass murder and elimination's perpetrators' comparative treatment of children is significant in multiple ways, beyond the most obvious fact, easily overlooked, that the dearth of systematic knowledge about the fate of children reminds us again that little analytical attention has been paid to exterminationist and eliminationist assaults, and that much knowledge has died with the victims. First and most significant is the perpetrators' disposition of the children themselves. Not that eliminationist perpetrators ever act well toward children or treat them with humanity, but some horrible fates are more horrible than others. Again, the Germans' various eliminationist assaults during the Nazi period offer the greatest insight. Germans adopted most methods for treating children. They did not target German communists and other heretics' children. They generally consigned Poles, Russians, and other putative subhumans' children to their parents' fates. They slaughtered and brutalized with particular thoroughness and relish the putative Jewish demons' demonic children. They stole and reared as Germans victim people's children, conforming in their personal physiognomy to the ideal of the master race, according to the Germans' crackpot racial, biological, ideological, and political accounting system. Second, just as with eliminationist programs' other central aspects, this aspect of the perpetrator's conduct provides insight into their mindsets and motives. Not all cruelties are compatible with all mindsets and motives. The perpetrator's excess cruelty, common in eliminationist and exterminationist onslaughts, and so frequent in some as to be a constituent feature, glaringly falsifies all postulates denying the perpetrator's approval of their deeds. This all but ignored analytical point is even much more evident regarding the perpetrator's treatment of and cruelty toward children. All those said to be killing or expelling the victims against their will, or merely out of obedience or because of peer pressure to help their comrades, would not possibly descend on victims' children with the perpetrator's fury, willful excess brutality, and glee. Third, the perpetrator's enormously widespread cruelty toward children tells us some further specific things about perpetrators' cruelty in general. It is obviously not Zimbardoian, not grounded in the social relations, guards facing recalcitrant prisoners, said to produce Zimbardoian cruelty. The children, posing no threat of resistance whatsoever, cannot possibly induce in the perpetrators the sense they must brutalize prisoners to control them. The perpetrator's cruelty toward children is also Machiavellian, if at all, only rarely. The circumstances and character of the perpetrator's cruelty toward children, perhaps only slightly less true of their cruelty toward adults, clarify their cruelty as an end in itself, for their satisfaction, without instrumental purpose. To the considerable extent that the perpetrator's cruelty toward children is vengeful, this merely further demonstrates, or rather unambiguously demonstrates, the perpetrator's thinking about the victim's hallucinatory quality. Children cannot possibly have done anything tangibly bad to the perpetrators, their families, or their groups or nations. Only to mindsets such as those of the German perpetrators, holding the victim's putative evil spirit to be coursing through all the victim's veins, would it make sense for perpetrators to feel such vengeful fury at the targeted group's children. Finally, the perpetrators' slaughter of and cruelty toward children thoroughly belie their hollow, self-exculpatory claims that they merely carry out a necessary task, or did not know they were acting wrongly or criminally, or had no choice, or any of the other postulates that they acted despite their lack of approval of the deed. Of course, their cruelty toward adults also belies their self-exculpatory claims that they did not want to kill or expel or otherwise brutalize the victim peoples. Returning to the perpetrator's general practice of cruelty returns us to the discussion's starting point. Whatever the differences in their cruelty's sources and practices, the two most fundamental facts are constant. The perpetrators know the victims suffer excruciating physical and emotional pain and often substantial wounds and injuries, and that they themselves, operating in their leaders' eliminationist programs, cause this suffering. No one can reasonably deny these two facts. The analysis here has focused on excess cruelty, for which the perpetrators are, by definition, that much more responsible. Their physical, verbal, and symbolic violence is gratuitous, unnecessary for the simple eliminationist act. They inflict it on their own initiative and at their pleasure. The perpetrator's knowledge of the victim's pain and suffering and of their role in causing it is true for excess cruelty's other forms, those embedded in camps and other eliminationist institutions' structure, in modes of work, and in the perpetrator's collective displays. All such cruelty appears natural and normative to the perpetrators because they think of those they hate or see as a threat, whether or not they dehumanize or demonize them, as beings they must violently eliminate, having themselves, by their own nature or deeds, earned this deserved fate. This was no less true among the British perpetrators in Kenya than elsewhere, as Nottingham, the former colonial administrator, attests, saying that the general approach was that they, the Kikuyu, were at fault for what they'd done. Tried to rise up, and so, okay, it didn't really matter very much how many died. They were just getting what they deserved. The cruelty appears natural also to the victims, a constituent feature of a world, their new world, the universe of eliminationist politics. The victims recognize that the perpetrator's conduct is utterly pathological according to conventional civilization standards, or rather of non-eliminationist civilization. But the perpetrator's quotidian cruelties quickly re-socialize the victims to bear and see the pathological as integral to their new social and personal worlds. This cruelty, flowing so naturally from people's eliminationist conceptions, becoming a natural and seemingly normative part of the programs based on such conceptions, is the perpetrator's self-justifying and satisfying self-expression. It is also the perpetrator's means of communicating with the victims about their nature, their abject state, their hopelessness, the ultimate fate awaiting them at the master's hands. Just as the perpetrators know they impart messages, often they make doubly sure by articulating them with overlordship, derision, and laughter, the victims receive the messages unmistakably. Liisa Malki, after recounting Burundian Tutsis' unbearably gruesome tortures and killings of pregnant Hutu women and others, explains how well the survivors living in the Tanzanian camp she studied understood the messages. The disemboweling of pregnant Hutu was interpreted as an effort to destroy the procreative capability, the new life of the Hutu people. In several accounts, the unborn child or embryo was referred to simply as the future. The penetration of the head through the anus, as well as other means of crushing the head, were seen as a decapitation of the intellect and, on a more general level, as an effort to render the Hutu people powerless, politically impotent. Reference was never made to any mutilation of the penis. In particular, it was said that the intention was to squash the Hutus' efforts to gain higher education. The message the Tutsi delivered was the same as the Hutu received, as was true with analogous messages from Germans to Herero, from Turks to Armenians, from Germans to Jews, from Serbs to Bosnians, from Tutsi to Hutu in Rwanda, from political Islamists to Darfurians, and from many more perpetrators to their victims. In Burundi, the Tutsi combined various eliminationist means to forestall a Hutu challenge to their power. They killed, prevented reproduction, and decapitated the Hutu collectively and individually. The Tutsi conveyed their message with sickening violence and sickening degradation, such as penetrating heads through anuses. In other words, with cruelty's unsurpassable and horrifying clarity. Actual worlds. In most eliminationist assaults, the spirit of overall policy, the institutions chosen to implement it, the communities of consent, and the individual actors' treatment of their individual victims spring by and large from the same source, the perpetrator's shared mindset. The political leaders and perpetrators in the field act with little, if any, opposition from their own people or victims. Thus, an unusual consonance typically exists in how the perpetrators reshape the world in their overall treatment of the targeted groups, the nature and functioning of institutions the perpetrators form, and of the communities in which they exist and which sustain them, and the perpetrators' personalized actions. These individual eliminationist worlds, communal worlds, institutional worlds, and personal worlds, add up everywhere, as perpetrators and their communities know and celebrate, to new or radically altered worlds, or, in Alphonse's words, to new days on the way. Nevertheless, differences exist in the worlds practitioners of eliminationist politics seek to create, and in how they choose to excise the malignant social and political tumors they see the targeted groups to be. Differences exist often within individual eliminationist assaults, and certainly across all such assaults, in the perpetrator's comprehensiveness in targeting different categories of victims, from total or near total to partial to selective or demonstration killings. Differences exist within individual eliminationist assaults and across all such assaults in how the perpetrators combine or selectively employ eliminationist means for their targets, whether the targets are different groups, political, ethnic, religious, or others, or different sexes or ages. The mixtures of transformation, repression, incarceration, expulsion, prevention of reproduction, and extermination vary enormously. The perpetrator's killing and treatment of women and children varies across eliminationist onslaughts, varies even at the same perpetrator's hands. The Nazis slaughtered Jewish, Sinti, and Roma families in toto, but did not target their German communist or socialist victims' families, among many others. Differences exist in the perpetrators' sequencing of their attacks, including when they kill people of different categories. Sometimes they target the entire universe of their victims simultaneously, sometimes the men first, sometimes the weak, leaving the strong for temporary labor exploitation. Some perpetrators create a camp system, with its far-reaching consequences for the regimes and societies. Others do not. Differences exist, also substantial, in the extent and kind of perpetrators' cruelty, which, like much else that perpetrators do and do not do, can be theorized and linked to the perpetrators' underlying conception of their victims. Differences exist sometimes within individual eliminationist assaults, and always across eliminationist assaults, on the level of overall eliminationist strategy, policy, and implementation, on the level of institutional design and functioning, and on the level of individual perpetrators' manner of treating targeted groups and individuals. Differences exist in the antiseptic halls of power, in the preparatory and hortatory airwaves, communities, and other means and locations of disseminating the views about hated and demeaned groups eventually targeted, and in the bloody, orderly, and wild killing fields and camps, where the perpetrators, anything but antiseptically, face, use, misuse, and cut down their victims. Some differences and variations can be accounted for only with in-depth treatment of each individual eliminationist assault, focusing on the perpetrator's conceptions of given targeted groups' natures and perniciousness, each country's and regime's politics, especially the political leader's political thinking and aspirations, each regime's leader's personal involvement and character, and their opportunities and constraints. Many eliminationist acts' compatibility with different conceptions of disparaged and despised groups, of perceived enemies, combined with uncertainties about opportunities for implementing different eliminationist measures and their likely efficacy, make it impossible to explain with certitude or to predict the eliminationist strategy, if any, leaders will embark upon, and then with what effect. Variations in opportunity, in leaders' calculations, and in the eliminationist desire's unpredictable expansion once perpetrators begin killing, makes predicting or even retrospectively explaining the outcomes still harder. About each eliminationist onslaught, a story can be told. A simple story and a multi-layered, complex, and detailed narrative, which is true, and which accounts for the kind of world the perpetrators create for themselves and their communities, and the place within it, if any, for the targeted peoples. Such a story would account for the initiation of the slaughter and eliminationist forays, the perpetrators' willingness to kill, their particular identities and forms of recruitment, the institutions used or devised, the victim's selection, the mass murder's scope and other outcomes, the perpetrators' consensual community's nature, and the mass murder and elimination's eventual end. But while each individual account is apt and explanatory, still in sum they coalesce into the sometimes looser and sometimes firmer patterns seen here, about which we can say and explain a great deal, but which often still defy general causal explanations. Whatever the other reasons, this, it should be remembered, is established as all but inevitable, given the idiosyncratic nature of the eliminationist mission's initiation and very definition, which depends so much on a few men's personalities, psychologies, hatreds, and calculations, and then on changing expectations, aspirations, and strategic goals and tactical possibilities once the always evolving onslaught begins and unfolds. How the perpetrators' notions evolve of how many and by what mixture of means they wish to eliminate the targeted group deserves more attention, as does their success in fulfilling their evolving notions at their different stages. Notice the term evolve. In eliminationist politics, the perpetrators more frequently evolve their notions from ideals to intentions to policy, each one itself sometimes changing with developing political contexts and events. Sometimes the perpetrators embark on a focused assault, a coup de grace, to eliminate once and for all a finite, if sometimes large, targeted group. In so many such assaults, however, the intended number of victims and eliminationist means changes along with facts on the ground, particularly if perpetrators construct a camp system as their civilization's constituent feature. Nevertheless, we should never lose sight of eliminationist politics and assault's most critical fact influencing virtually every aspect, from the creation of ideals to intentions to plans to the decision to initiate them as policy to the plethora of ways perpetrators on the ground implement them. People's conceptions of the others. Whether or not the perpetrators demonize or dehumanize them, and how they understand the impediment, danger, or threat they see those others to be, is fundamental for how they intend to treat the others, how they actually treat them, and how they would be willing to treat them. The keen memoirist Oscar Pincus captures this critical and unavoidable eliminationist factor brilliantly in his description of a paradigmatic occurrence in the Germans' eliminationist assault on European Jewry, an account that could have similarly occurred in Bosnia, Rwanda, and so many eliminationist assaults around the world. In 1940, young German soldiers, Western Front veterans, arrived in Wojcica, a town of 8,000 in Poland's Lublin region. They initially acted courteously. Then they learned the town's denizens were mainly Jews and immediately they were transformed. Pincus explains, their Z turned to do. They made us polish their boots and clubbed us for not tipping our hats promptly. Nothing had changed. The Germans beheld people looking and acting exactly as before. Yet everything had changed. The Germans had gained knowledge that the people's identity was their hated and putatively demonic foes whom they, for the first time, could attack. Like their countrymen across Central and Eastern Europe, they immediately became, in Pincus' apt formulation, transformed, using the demeaning "du" form of address instead of the normal, respectful "Sie," exacting symbolic obeisance, and beating the people not because of anything the people did and not because of sudden new orders, but for only one reason: the Germans' prior prejudices about and hatreds of Jews. Actual minds create actual worlds.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.